Laura is, as Claire said, daughter of Lord Duncan Sandys, who as an MP established the Civic Trust in 1957 and in 1967 instigated the Civic Amenities Act. Laura herself was MP for South Thanet from 2010 to 2015 and was the chair of the all-party parliamentary group for civic societies. She was also key to the development of Civic Voice, which took over the reins of the Civic Trust. And she is now Vice President of Civic Voice and is currently promoting celebrations for 50 years of conservation areas nationally. Hence her very, very welcome presence here today.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is great to be here and it's lovely to be part of Brockley. And this is one of the most beautiful, what I would call London lungs. I mean, gosh, what a wonderful, wonderful park you have here. And how important it was that 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, somebody said that we must make our community, we must maintain its green spaces, we must give people of all sorts of people, with all from all sorts of communities, the benefit of having a green space that really unites and in many ways creates cohesion for the communities around it. And that's what civic societies are about. They're about people like yourselves. They're people who can stand up for the community, not always talking about the grand, not always talking about the palace or the museum, but talking about the place in which people live, the roads which people walk down, the community in which they build. And that is what Brockley Society, and I know Telegraph Hill is here, and no doubt other representatives from around Lewisham. Jimmy, may I call you Jimmy? Made a very, very clear statement about also how societies work very closely with local authorities. And to have passionate advocates like you as a partner in many ways developing and ensuring that the community and its planning and its future is built on the narrative, not just of the future, but also of the past, is absolutely crucial. I wanted to say that my background has been very much involved with local authorities, and as a Member of Parliament, I saw how important a civic society and the environment in which people live in work. So I give you a little story. I used to represent Ramsgate, and I don't know how many people know Ramsgate. It's an area, actually, that has a huge amount of poverty. Very, very low income part of the southeast, with lots of challenges and lots of difficulties. But what united that community was the narrative, the story of its architecture. It was built by... it was really built for the Napoleonic Wars, and so you had all these squares. Spencer Square, which is where General Spencer was, Nelson Crescent, Wellington Crescent. And the stories that came out of these buildings was what united the community. So you had on one side of Ramsgate, you had where all the big generals used to stay, and on the other side, you had where all the ladies of the night used to entertain the generals. And these are stories that actually bring communities alive. You have them here in Brockley, you have them across Lewisham, that unite. And when we went through a certain period, and 50 years ago was the anniversary, and today is this year is the anniversary of the Amenities Act. 50 years ago, there was an era of, in many ways, people would call architectural brutalism, where we were rejecting the narrative of the past that brought us together as communities for the future. I don't know whether you know the Nash buildings in Regent's Park? They were all going to come down. We've got Whitehall, Banqueting House. The whole of Whitehall was going to be destroyed. Can you think of that today? Can you imagine the bulldozers going in and taking down the majority of Whitehall? There's a great cartoon of my dad looking like Guy Fawkes putting the dynamite underneath these plans, because that's what we were doing. The city of Chester one of the most beautiful, absolutely iconic medieval cities, going to be flattened. We've got to have a modern city, don't we? And all those, you know, all those really irritating medieval buildings costing us a lot, and all the wood that needs to be restored, and all the daub and wattle that needs to be put back in. Let's get rid of it. Let's have a new city, a new plan. City of Chester was going to be demolished. And then we have these fabulous ideas, which actually maybe some people in this room have been involved, were involved in. I'm sure you're not old enough, but the whole of Covent Garden. We were going to have a dual carriageway going from the City of London right the way across, knocking down Aldwych, right the way across Covent Garden Market. That was going to be demolished. And Trafalgar Square was going to be turned into a spaghetti junction of motorways, because this was super desirable. Because what we want is we want a lot more air pollution, don't we? And we want a lot more tarmac. And we don't want markets in the middle of cities when we can put up tire blocks and we can ensure that we can move transport from A to B in as quick a time as possible. These were things that were going on 50 years ago. And who stopped them? It wasn't really a little bit the political dimension and the debate that was going on. But ultimately, it was people who stopped this. There were riots in central London trying to save Covent Garden Market. And I've got some fabulous pictures right at the very end of people with banners, because actual people power does matter. So this was a period that was called the Age of Blindness, and it was almost religious. And my father was in the department, which wasn't called, it was called Department of Supply, but it would be now called the Department of, probably of Environment, and it certainly was doing a lot of housing. And there was this big fight between those people, you know, modernity and new architecture and concrete is absolutely the future. We must reject all of the past. And also, we were going through a huge amount of reconstruction after the war. And so anything that looked old or tired, we needed to get rid of. And it really was religious. And so much so that my father set up something called the Civic Trust. And that was this sort of an amalgam of all the civic societies around the country. This was in 57. And he set up an organization to lobby himself, to be an activist group, to be a people group that was actually going to say to the department that he ran, this isn't right. Are you listening? Do you understand what that story, the Ramsgate story about the ladies of the night and the generals in every single community, what are you destroying? The permanent secretary, the chief civil servant, was furious. And said, how on earth can you set up this people movement on one hand when you're the politician and you're meant to be making the decisions? And in too many circumstances, and maybe I make a bigger political point here, too many circumstances, politicians are not listening enough to the people on the ground and actually understanding where people's values are, not where the cost is, but where the value to the community is. So he was also encouraged Prince Charles to be the first patron of the Civic Trust. And I would say it was probably Prince Charles's, he was very young, I think he was about 19. It was his very first sort of touching things to do with the environment, which of course he is extremely well known and a very strong activist. So what did this legislation do? It created conservation areas. Now, 27 conservation areas, or 27 civic societies you have just in Lewisham, that is phenomenal. And that is about you being there at the front line, making your voice heard. So, let's sit back. It's fantastic. It's all going really, really well. We've job done. We've got the legislation. We've got all these civic societies. We've got everybody out there doing and making things work. And so we can be totally complacent from now on. We don't need to worry about, as I say, the codes are there, the legislation are there. I should think the Broccoli Society rather disagree with me on that one. Because is the job done? In 1969, my father said that conservation areas were being eroded because of scarce resources. because of lack of heritage, properly trained heritage conservation officers. And I would say to you that you probably feel very similar to that. And actually, more cuts are coming down the line, and we're going to find ourselves absolutely looking at these things that are of value to the communities being undermined. And so it is absolutely crucial at this moment that we are a vocal group, not just here in Broccoli, but nationally as well, and ensuring that we get our message across that the public care. And when the public's environment, the public's living space is either eroded or undermined, that there is a voice that is there holding them to account. So we are having some salami slicing of what expertise is out there. Right across the communities, we are losing conservation staff, and we're losing the training capacity. So apparently now we've got training when you're in a planning, when you're going through planning training, it's, I think, about sort of 4 or 5 hours maximum on conservation areas. And with the number of conservation areas that we have around the country, that seems wholly inadequate in my view. We've also got an erosion of numbers. Now, I think you've got 1.5 conservation officers in Lewisham. No? Right. Between 1.5 and 2 conservation officers in Lewisham. However, think of Birmingham, the size of the city of Birmingham. They only have 2 conservation officers for the whole of Birmingham. So we are looking at resource being lost, and that is where it's absolutely phenomenal what you're doing, because in many ways you are filling that gap. But is that enough, and should we be asking for more? So as the front line, as you as organisations at the barricades, ensuring that the voice of the community is heard, ensuring that the long-term environment is preserved, you are an extraordinary resource. And right up and down the country, there is groups like the Broccoli Society that are absolutely there bringing the community together. And I know that this is what you're already doing, but I would encourage you to ensure that every time you see anything that you feel is maybe small, but maybe the salami slicing of the community that we live in, maybe undermining that sense of cohesion that in many ways the conservation areas create, that you're there to support that community and support this area to ensure that we get the best for the future, and ensure that we don't end up being in many ways pushed around by easy development decisions and easy, less complicated, less contentious council decisions, that we need to ensure that they are serving the long term, not just the short term. I think your Member of Parliament is Heidi Alexander. Oh, right, Vicky. I don't know Vicky. I know Heidi, who I have a huge amount of time for and is absolutely lovely. But anyway, it is a great moment because people really do, and politicians are really super sensitive to the public. And it would be great for you to have a joint meeting with all your MPs in Lewisham, actually, and talk about what they will do in this Parliament to ensure that we don't erode the resources that go into conservation. That you can ask them to join the all-party group for civic societies. The civic society group is actually going to be looking at proposing legislation to tighten up what we currently have in terms of codes and standards, because the monitoring and the capacity of councils is being eroded in terms of being able to monitor that. So I hope that maybe there should be a sort of delegation that wants to go and talk to your members of Parliament collectively and ensure that we get that support in Parliament that we so badly need. And the civic voice is doing the big conversation about conservation. And so please, I would urge you to get involved. I would urge you to become part of civic voice and to ensure that everybody's collective strength, everybody's collective power is put in many ways to our common ends. We're going to be looking at recruiting 500 community groups to participate across England. There are lots of events going on up and down the country, and we will be ensuring that your message also gets to both the department, to the number 10, and also throughout the civil service. So we are in some ways a function, a channel for you to get your voice amplified. And I'm sure you're all doing this anyway, but I just encourage a lot more media and a lot more feistiness from everybody. And whether that be, you know, the Evening Standard campaigns, whether it be looking at your local media, but super, super important, as we know, is all the social media aspects of that. And I think it's really crucial that we sort of start to up our game and engage people. Even if they won't come to meetings, you can engage them enormously through social media and get that momentum running. I know that we're also doing quite a lot of work centrally with people like Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, housing associations. I'm sure that they all have a lot of organisations here on the ground. And I think it would be really, really exciting to bring, in many ways, some of the natural environmental groups as well as the built environmental groups, and bring that together with some of the housing, the sort of leading housing people. Sometimes I think housing associations are very, very good, but sometimes they do need to be held to account as well for some of the decisions that they're making. So I see them as being both partners, but also they're targets for persuasion too. There is no single factor that's going to organise and preserve our conservation areas and is going to absolutely ensure that we get the best for the future. But people power matters. You matter. You matter more than ever. And absolutely crucial that you're given the support that you need in a local context, and that we ensure that we've got a strong voice nationally. I think this is a moment for us to all stand up and to absolutely embrace the sense of what communities can do together. I would urge you to, as I say, encourage people to engage with the new legislation that the Civic Voice will be coming up with to ensure that we have stronger controls over our conservation areas. But fundamentally, I want to commend you, because you're the people who are actually making it happen. And organisations, civic societies like yours up and down the country are the absolute front line, the front line at the barricades, ensuring that we are keeping our past to feed and to support our future. And that is what conservation is about. It is not about yesterday, it's about tomorrow, it's about community cohesion, and it's about community action. And I have to say, it looks great here from this end, looking at you, because that's what you are. Thank you very much indeed. Is any questions?
I think we might take questions in sort of batches of three.
Yes, totally. I'm in your hands.
So, yes.
Fab. You're far too young for that. Go on.
Homes as lasting longer than 10 years. So we're set up to remember these homes and your father's part in it as well, and also to try and conserve some areas where there are prefabs and listed prefabs, like in Birmingham, which
yes.
we're currently battling to save. So, you know, thanks very much to your dad.
Well, listen, thank you very much, and what a great organiser. Sorry, we're going to do it in threes. All right,
if
I will.
If you want to respond to that one.
Congratulations on what you're doing. And the prefab movement actually got a very, very bad name, and really is very, very interesting. But it's actually coming back, and there's some really exciting stuff around manufactured homes and integrated energy systems that are part of that. And to be frank, it was part of a very important narrative straight post-war, but I'm sure, actually, we're going to see a lot more manufactured homes of very, very, very high standard. And I think it's an exciting movement that hasn't just got a past, I think it's got a future. So congratulations.
Good morning, that was brilliant. Thank you very much. Roger Lewis, chairman of the St. John Society, which is an adjacent conservation area just to the north of Brockley. Two questions, really. It seems to me, and I've got a broader interest in architecture and architectural preservation and so on, that the legislation as it stands isn't robust enough. So changes can happen in conservation areas that the council will say, you know, we've got no powers to stop this, you know, Article 4 directive, it only goes so far. So I'm interested first in what sort of statutory powers a new Act of Parliament could have, you know, a new Conservation Areas Act or something. So that's my first question. Second is that nothing, as I'm sure you know, in this country happens generally unless it gets a stamp of approval from Downing Street, such as our very centrist style of government. And I wonder that I would argue there's been a general decline in architectural standards since the 1920s, 30s, 40s, you know, this is the Edwin Lutyens tradition, and so that civic pride in our built architecture. And as such, could there be a sort of, you know, literally top down, and I mean sort of cabinet level architectural commission that says there are certain standards that housing, public buildings should reach? Because at the moment, I mean, in Lewisham we've had, I don't know where to begin, we've had so many abuses of what I would say just basic sound architectural standards, and I think I speak for most people in this room to say we're all a bit depressed about the present situation.
Okay, so
if
we just have one more question and then
Sorry, thanks very much indeed. I'm very concerned at the moment about the developers, particularly on old buildings, which are not necessarily conservation buildings, but there is considerable deliberate neglect of buildings at the present moment of time, whereby developers are leaving sites open, opening windows, putting boardings inside windows, and not really preserving that at all in any shape or form. And the big thing, we talked about media on here, but the big thing we have lost in recent years is the local newspapers. Not everybody has access to the internet, not everybody has, and it's the lack of information from the local newspapers, and maybe it's something that the Civic Trust could consider actually producing their own newspaper, which would be available to local areas. I know it would be a cost, but I think many people would be more than happy to pay a small contribution towards getting that out, getting the message out in the community.
Thank you. Okay, over to you, Laura. So that was
this one last lady.
Oh,
I'm very happy to take.
Okay, go for it.
Hello. Well, I'm very, very pleased that you are aware that England and our world is under threat. I've lived in this area over 50 years, and you know, it's been absolutely lovely, but Lewisham, Deptford, in those years, we have got problems, and they can all be solved. Certain things have to happen, and we are doing our most. The Realist Party was formed at Stansted Airport with one of my colleagues saying, what's happening to our country? What's happening to our world? We've got to do something, and we have. So the Realist Party has arrived, and we are going to look after Brockley, England, and the world.
Wow, that's fantastic. no, I mean, as I say, people are what
is what matters. And your power and your organising power is absolutely crucial at the heart of this. So, you know, I absolutely respect what people have done in this community and wider. But actually what we also need to do is to make that a collective rather than just being able to be picked off one by one. And that sort of really feeds into the legislation side, is that how many times in your work or in your life do you hear people say, well, we can't do that because the regs don't allow us, or procurement won't allow us to do X, Y, and Z? To be frank, in every environment, not least in local authorities, it's always easier to blame something else. And to be frank, the codes certainly that have been employed in some local authorities are pretty strong. Sometimes it's the enforcement that is not actually happening. And the lack of resources, I talked about heritage officers, actually the lack of resources on enforcement is one of the very big problems too. And to be frank, you are the enforcement officers. You might not like that, but you are. You're the front line of this, and in many ways it's about organising effectively to ensure that, that there is a sort of voice that comes through on a regular basis. I'll come back to your legislative point, because that then feeds into your point about local media. And there is this picture here. This is Save Covent Garden. And I'm not suggesting that every Saturday you go out with banners, but it is about local organisation, and it is about actually making sure that you get that local media. I mean, I would be very, very clear that the Civic Voice is in no position to do local newspapers, but what it can be doing, and to be frank, while you say some people aren't on the internet, it is true that, but in some ways the additional cost to get to that next level is so huge. But what we should be doing is doing, in many ways, sharing stories with everybody, all the civic societies, about successes, about failures, about new campaigns, to give you all the sense that you're not on your own, because you're just not on your own. Everybody up and down the country is doing the same things, is trying to address the same issues, is trying to look at some of the bad development, the bad permissions, the lack of enforcement. And so I would say that there is a very, very important sharing job that really needs to be there. And maybe some electronic templates and things like that can be helpful. I come back to your legislation point of view, position, and it is absolutely crucial. And we're working on this at the moment. It was going to be submitted as part of a submission in the next couple of weeks, but then the election happened in between and there's been a bit of a manifesto period, right? What is crucial is that we look at all the mentions and reference points to conservation areas across legislation and tick it up one in terms of both needing to be accommodated, needing to be enforced, and needing to be considered, right? I think that there is very, very important to get that, I need you, because this needs to be seen from the people, not just from central organisations. And so we'll be launching an online petition and we'll be really pushing this forward. But it is absolutely crucial that when you look at the planning frameworks, when you look at this dash for houses that is going on at the moment, and to be frank, rightly so, the issue is that we don't have a dash for second-rate houses, that we don't have a dash for houses that will create fuel poverty, for example, that we don't have a dash for houses that will be slums in 10 years. And I've just been sort of made aware of a big, big housing development just outside, just in Kent, and they have had 15% of their homes have not been signed off by planning, by housing quality standards, right? Now, that is very, very unusual. It's normally 1% that doesn't get through. 15% of new houses being built, which are being moved in to by young families, not meeting the standards, and that is a very, very big problem. And so we have got at the same time this rush for development and standards plummeting. And that is a recipe for disaster. And I feel very much for these families because they have, you know, every single penny of their lives being invested in very nice but quite modest homes. And then they arrive and find that these new homes are a super disappointment, that there are major structural problems, and that we're not keeping standards. So I believe that we should be conflating our agenda when it comes to conservation and it comes to those standards with a similar aspiration for new build too. And if we can create a much stronger coalition, which is talking about young families, people wanting to get on the housing ladder, but standards across the board being important, we're going to find it a much easier lever to pull. But as I say, ultimately, it's all your advice and your knowledge that's important for us to actually make the difference.
Thank you. Yes, there's another question in the middle there.
Thank you very much. My name's Paul Russell. I'll be speaking a little bit later. I'm an architect. That appears to make me the enemy. I mean, if we get a guy here saying architectural standards have declined since the 1930s, well, I'm bound to disagree with that as a practicing architect. Yes, there have been some dodgy periods of architecture. I think there's some very good architecture being produced now. Okay. My view would be that too often the conservation aspect is what is hindering good design, not helping. I was very pleased that you were talking there about the future and about modern buildings. I think that the whole name, conservation area, is causing a lot of problems. Because of, obviously you've got to conserve some things, but too often that in a lot of people's minds that means preserving an aspect. There really has to be the where's the good modern architecture coming in that's going to enhance these areas. I'd like to see a much greater emphasis on encouraging good architecture rather than, as all too often, I'm forced into producing second-rate pastiches because that's all I can get through planning.
Okay. No, and I don't, I mean, on one level, I certainly don't disagree, and I didn't really pick up on the point that you were saying that architectural standards have gone down. I actually disagree with this gentleman on that, because I actually think that we do have some very exciting architecture that has come through, and the modern and the old need to work together. As you look at any medieval town centre, you've got 400 years of architecture of different periods all working together and interrelating together. But the point is has the narrative been thought through? And that I do think is important for people and for place. And I think that it's absolutely important that these things complement each other. So I would totally agree that I think architectural standards are very, very exciting. I'm also concerned, though, I think that there is an issue around not necessarily a great architect like yourself, but when we're talking, we're not just talking about architecture in its purest sense. In some instances, we're just talking about building, and people are just building stuff, right? And are they looking at that stuff and thinking, in 25 years' time, will that be a place for people? Will that actually have the quality and the long-termism that actually builds a community? Or is it chuck it up, sell it off, and walk away? And we've got some real issues here, and it's very interesting because if you look in Europe, where people actually have a very different relationship with property in terms of rental, actually, some of the development that is done there by landlords who have long-term interests in these property and these particular developments, they look at them in quite a different way. So it's not chuck them up and sell them, it's build them and sustain an income from them over a very long period of time. So we do have some quite strange misalignments, I think, in our housing. So I don't think it's either or on architecture. I think it is to do with quality. And I think that everybody, whether it's a housing association, whether it's a social housing, or whether it's some form of upmarket housing development, everybody deserves a quality home with a quality community around it.
I'm surprised you see Covent Garden as a success. I mean, when Brian Anson left the GLC to form the Covent Garden Association, Residents' Association, when he was fighting with the GLC, it was seen then as a lively, rich community and very varied. Now it's just a sort of playground for the rich. It's just a sort of, you know, it costs £5 million for a one-bedroom flat there. There's no living community there. It's completely lost. I mean, you're taken in by the veneer of the architecture. Behind that, there's really nothing there.
Okay.
It's a sort of crowded, dead zone, really, with no living community.
What I was saying is that they were going to knock it all down.
Sorry?
They were going to knock it all down. So it wasn't
going to be there at all. Yeah, but they've knocked down. The community doesn't exist anymore. It's nothing like the community. No, it's a central
but,
London.
But what the campaign was about was to stop a dual carriageway going right across it and knocking the whole area down.
No, the campaign was to retain the community, was to retain the people there. The poor people living in the community were meant to be retained in the community. It didn't happen.
Very possibly. I mean, I don't personally know, but all I do know is that there was the option to knock the whole thing down and create a dual carriageway, which certainly wouldn't have retained any community. And what it,
I don't know, to be honest.
What my interest with the Covent Garden issue was, is this issue around reuse and how you change places that can be they can be reutilized in different ways. I mean, I'm not there to dispute one way or the other whether Covent Garden has been a success or not, but it does exist, and that I think is better than a dual carriageway, which would have actually not just destroyed Covent Garden, but it would have changed the whole environment of the Strand right the way up, and it would have just created, I mean, it was creating a motorway in the middle of London, and that's what it was trying to do. Okay. Well, I apologise for
I think we've
for
got
not
time for a few more questions.
Reflecting
one there.
Your issue there, but
Annabel McLaren, Chair of the Sydenham Society.
Hello. Hi. Society. Fantastic. We've got hundreds of them here.
Okay. What advice could you give us in Sydenham, where we're trying to preserve late 19th century gas holders and not have them demolished and replaced with an Aldi supermarket?
Well, that's not one that I've come across before. However, I mean, I think it's very interesting. If you look at, I think industrial architecture is really interesting, and it gives us a sense of, if you go down to Canary Wharf or further than that, down by the Siemens building, they've maintained a lot of the sort of rigs that were part of the ports and all the rest of it. And I think that there is, and done it really beautifully, I think that there is a way of transposing industrial architecture into community architecture. And again, I talk about stories. I think it's about you thinking what the story is that builds and ensures that your gas storage tanks stay. I mean, I can't quite get there, but I'm working on it. But I think that there's a way to ensure that you create the atmosphere and the community. And it's also about what the visual dimensions are of who people, you know, what people look onto, etc. I don't know whether you've done a survey of your local, of the proximity of your area. All right, okay.
But they are, within the context of probably Lower Sydenham's most significant industry, which employed a couple of thousand people, you know, from 1880 to 1970 or so. So there is a story there.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, the vision of the King's Cross equivalent, I think, is a really important one. If you're talking about homes, I think that homes seem to be a much bigger, or should be a much bigger political priority than another supermarket.
Continuing that one, because I'm very heavily involved with it, I'm David Perrett, Chair of the Greater London Industrial Archaeology Society.
Oh, very
and
fantastic.
The whole of London at the moment is suffering from gasholder demolition. We've been fighting very hard to save some of them. We've succeeded, the King's Cross ones come about because of our insistence that they would preserve the twin gasholders anyway. At other sites, English Heritage have declared in the last 4 or 6 weeks, I can't remember the exact date, that they will not consider the listing of any more gas holders in the country, as far as I can work out. Currently, we're fighting for Fulham gas holders, which are the oldest ones in the world, or the oldest gas holder in the world is there. We've lost the battle on Old Kent Road on the southeast. The problem, though, is one of brownfield sites and the size and the value. The amount of money that developers can pour into brownfield sites, you know, the King's Cross Goods Yard development, going to become Google headquarters, Heatherwick's, but it's all size, and it's you can remove anything. In this borough, we've lost the whole of Deptford Dockyard with very little archaeological investigation, although some, but the old buildings were pulled down in order to see what was underneath for the Museum of London, I think. I know it wasn't the Museum of London, but the developer. So it's size and scale. You know, the whole of the Olympic site went without anybody hardly taking any conservation photographs at all on the Olympic site. On the peninsula at Greenwich, again, the same size and scale of development. And actually, small amateur groups, you might say, such as ourselves, although we have nearly 900 members in London, we can't battle against big developers.
I'm certainly not disputing that it's easy, and I'm certainly not disputing that, volunteers in organisations like yours don't do a massive amount of work, and it sometimes feels like you're banging your head against brick wall constantly. But I do think, though, that, your experiences of the King's Cross development is really, really important. And, I mean, I don't know, does the local MP know? Have you...
Yes.
Have you spoken to, the Evening Standard? Is there ways of trying to up the ante on it?
The list of losing sites at the moment is considerable. Whitechapel Bell Foundry closed 2 weeks ago. We've got a massive potential battle up in North London over the Royal Gunpowder Works, which are up for redevelopment now. It's a failed site. Because of the PGL holidays, want to build a children's holiday camp on the site now, but it is simply massive. But yeah, it's a big challenge. We have an all-party industrial heritage committee in Parliament, of which I'm a member.
Would you make sure that they get in touch with the all-party civic society group?
I've already made a note of that
one.
No,
seriously, and I think it's
because we went into Purdah, so we. We haven't met recently.
Purdah, I always thought, was meant to protect the citizen from the government, not always the government from the citizen. But anyway,
thank you very much. I think we.
Thank you very much, and what a great. And just congratulations for everything you do. It is so important and so much part of what the future looks like. And thank you for everything.